What's it like when you're trying to preserve your traditions in your language? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Today we're going to talk with a teacher from the Miccosukee tribe. Like many of the native groups, it's a challenge for them to protect their traditions and language of their ancestors. We'll talk about how the Miccosukee children are learning that cultural heritage in school. Also, the Palm Beach County School District is looking for a new leader. Earlier this week, the superintendent resigned. But why, after only just a few years? Is Palm Beach County a premier district that can attract a great superintendent? Finally, the Marlins just keep getting rid of people. This time, they fired their mascot. Sort of. All of that on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, the Palm Beach County School District will soon be hiring. They're looking for a new superintendent. On Monday, news broke that Superintendent Robert Avosa was resigning. Avosa himself had to scurry to tell the school board members before they found out from the media or social media. School board members had confidence in Avosa and were ready to give him another raise. Now, they have to find another leader just a few years after they hired him. Avosa started back in 2015. We're joined now by Palm Beach Post reporter Andrew Mara. Andrew, all right, I mean, it caught a lot of people off guard. The news got out actually before Avosa made it official himself. What happened on Monday?
Well, that's right, Lewis. He was, as we understand it, he was getting close to announcing it. He had put together a resignation letter, and later Monday afternoon he was going to alert his school board members and then I think the his staff and teachers. At the Palm Beach Post here, we got a tip about it a little bit beforehand, and of course moved quickly to try and confirm it. And so we had reached some school board members to try and confirm it, and we asked them. They said they didn't know anything about it. They weren't aware that he was resigning. Didn't think it was an accurate tip. But one of them called him to confirm, and he did in fact tell them yes, he was planning to send over a resignation letter later that afternoon. And then at that point, he had to move quickly to, speed up the timeline.
All right. So what have school board members, what have officials with the school district said so far about this news?
Well, everyone is really stunned and surprised by it. And I think the school board members are still reeling because they, of course, now find themselves having to go through another search. It really just caught everyone off guard. Of course, superintendents, you know, sometimes come and go, and 3 years is about an average stay for a superintendent at a large school district. But he had been making indications that he was intending to stay for a longer term, and so I think it did catch a lot of folks off guard. And now they're sort of struggling to figure out what the next step is.
So this is a very large school district in the country, a high profile position. I know it just happened the other day, but I mean, are people talking, outside groups, individuals may be interested in the job from anywhere around the state or even around the country?
Well, certainly there's always folks in public school systems around the country looking to make the next move. A lot of folks do, you know, spend their careers dreaming of being a superintendent one day because it is such a powerful position, an important position. At this point, a lot of the talk has been about looking internally, because that is Dr. Vosa's own recommendation to his board. And some board members at this point say they think that's possibly a smart thing to do. So a lot of the talk has been about looking internally, but there is some pushback on that. Some people do want to look around the country as well, because, of course, there are talented administrators everywhere and a lot of potential all across the state and the country.
Yeah, he did say, Avosa said in his letter, that he would hope, right, that the school board would hire perhaps one of his top lieutenants. I mean, who are these folks?
Well, he does have, there's a lot of people who could be considered and have been considered in the past. Some of his staff are folks who have been finalists for superintendent jobs elsewhere in the state. And so there are a lot of potential contenders. Some of the folks whose names have been mentioned a bit are his sort of number two deputy. The deputy superintendent is David Christensen. There's another top chief, who's the chief operating officer, Donald Fenoy. These are two people who Dr. Vosa brought with him when he took the top job here. So they're people who've been working with him for a long time, or at least who he's known for a long time, and I think probably share his vision to a large extent, and I think he'd prefer that one of them
considered. As you mentioned, some members of the school board have also said perhaps better to hire from within, but I mean, what's the chance that would happen?
I think Avosa's recommendation carries a lot of weight with some members of the school board. I think some of them are sort of, I think the argument would be people who are on board now know sort of the current game plan and the strategic plan that Avosa and his staff set up, and that one of those people could carry that forward with more continuity than bring someone in who has to, from outside, who has to learn not just the system, but all the people, the dynamics, and the politics here. So that is an argument that some board members have sort of taken to. But, of course, there's also other compelling arguments for looking outside as well. So it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds. And I think next week they'll be discussing that and deciding which route to go.
Again, I'm talking with Palm Beach Post reporter Andrew Mara, uncovering the story about, again, Palm Beach County School District Superintendent Robert Avosa resigning this week, stepping down after just a few years on the job. What is the school district going to do next? And by the way, if you live in Palm Beach County and you got kids in the school district, you can always find us on Facebook. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can share your thoughts, find us to WLRN Sundial, and tell us what you think about what Mr. Avosa's tenure, his short tenure as superintendent, was like. Did you like what he did? Did you like anything he did? Or maybe you didn't like what he was doing? And what kind of leader should they look for next? Again, find us on Facebook at WLRN Sundial. They just gave him a raise recently. It wasn't that long ago, right, Andrew?
And
That's correct. They made him the highest paid superintendent in the state. So they liked
him. They certainly did. He came in with a lot of acclaim. He made a really great impression on them when he came, and he had had a good track record in Fulton County, Georgia, where he had been superintendent for a few years. He was brought in at a annual base salary of $325,000 a year, which at the time was the largest in the state and one of the largest in the country for superintendents of large school districts. Since then, I think the superintendent Broward and Miami-Dade have received raises that have put them slightly above his, but they're all in the same general range now.
So what did the board members really like about him, and did they see any downside to him? Did they have any criticisms of anything he had done?
Well, he came in with he received a lot of praise for coming in, sort of methodically analyzing and identifying some of the key issues with the district, developing a plan and getting a lot of buy-in from the community for what to do, focusing on a few key outcomes that they wanted to really stress, things like raising the high school graduation rate, elementary school reading levels, that sort of thing. He received a lot of acclaim for that. I think one of his chief assets was just his great role as sort of the face of the school district. He was really high profile. He was an excellent public speaker. He spoke really well on camera. He did a lot of media, more so than I think superintendents who preceded him in that role. And so he was really out there a lot, did a lot of public appearances, and just really became really prominent in the community. It was a lot of people had a positive impression of him that really I think the school district really benefited from that, and so that really helped to make the case for things like a sales tax increase that was approved a year and a half ago, and he was the kind of the lead salesman for that, and the district did benefit from that, and I think a lot of people gave him credit for that.
If they decide, if the school district decides to do a national search, how long does that process take?
Now, they did do one. He was brought here through a national search, and I think that one took about 3 months. Not as long as you would maybe think, but it does take a bit of time because first you have to find the search firm, and that's a process. Search firm has to set up, and there's a community input element to it. I think it was about 3 months from start to finish in bringing him here back in early 2015. So it doesn't take it doesn't have to take a huge long period of time, but there is a cost to it, and it does push things back a bit.
Is this a desirable job?
Well, it depends what you're looking for. It's a it everyone says it's a very difficult job. It's you're being pulled in so many directions, and Palm Beach County, in addition to being a large school district, it's also the largest county in area in the state of Florida. So not only do you have a lot of constituents, you know, 190,000 students or so, all their parents, et cetera, just geographically, it's huge. And from Jupiter to Boca Raton, it's a lot of ground to cover if you're the sort of superintendent who wants to be out and about and making appearances. So it can really be grueling. And, of course, there's all sorts of political pressures. There's state politics. So it is. It can certainly be exhausting, and we've seen that. I think Avosa was referencing that in making his decision to seek work in the private sector.
Now, he's going to be in there until June, so basically until the end of this school year. Is there any harm that could come to the district in the short period between him and his successor?
Well, the school board is concerned. A lot of folks are concerned just about you know, things going off track potentially. I mean, he will be here to see things through to the end of the year. I don't think there's so much concern about that as there is about what comes next. Who replaces him will be someone with the same skill sets, with the same vision. There's so many variables there, and I think that's where some of the discomfort comes from, just not knowing what the future will hold for some of the plans they've gradually put in place over the last couple of years for some reforms to the school system.
Before I let you go, I wanted to ask you about he's staying in the area, and he's taking a job in the private sector. He's working for a publishing company. Has anyone said anything, though, about the fact that he's leaving to work at a publishing company that does educational products and materials? I mean, it sort of sounds like a lawmaker that leaves office and then becomes a lobbyist, you know, because of his contacts. Is there an issue there?
Well, it has some similarities, and it's not unusual for public educators to go into the private sector where they then in turn turn around and do work with a school district. It does happen a lot, particularly folks in school districts on the construction side of things who oversee construction projects then might go and work for a construction company, or folks who turn around and sell products back to the school district or even their own services. You often will see former principals and administrators come back and work as consultants. And I don't know specifically how much business the school district does with LRP publications. They certainly do produce a lot of literature, not so much textbooks, but things for administrators, things, you know, educational materials on the latest in federal policy changes. I'm sure folks here in our school district do consume a lot of those products. To what that means in dollar terms, I don't know. But that's certainly something that we will be keeping an eye on and to see if there, if that relationship develops further as Dr. Avosa moves there.
Andrew Mara, again, a reporter with the Palm Beach Post, talking about Robert Avosa's Palm Beach County School Superintendent, resigning this week. He's leaving in June. What is the district going to do next? We'll keep up on this story as well as we get more information. Andrew, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lewis. Appreciate it.
All right, coming up next, we're going to talk more education. We're going to talk with a teacher from the Miccosukee tribe, and we're going to learn more about how they are fighting to protect their traditions and their culture. That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, here in South Florida, there are tribal lands, some deep in the Everglades and some in the Miami and Fort Lauderdale suburbs. We're going to talk today about our Miccosukee neighbors, known formally as the Miccosukee Tribe of Indians of Florida. My guest is William Osceola. He teaches at the Miccosukee Indian School. Mr. Osceola, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
You know what? First of all, so we get a picture because some people may not know, and I didn't know until I was looking it up, but where exactly are the Miccosukee lands?
It's west of Miami, right? If you go down A Street, pretty much you're going to hit the swamps, and that's when kind of you go like 20 miles past where our resort is. That's where our main reservation is. That's where the school will be located, and that's all our lands over there.
Do most members of the Miccosukee tribe, do they live on those lands?
Or Majority do. I myself actually live out in Miami, but fairly close there. I'm like 5 minutes from the resort, so I'm not too far away.
Why is that? I mean, was that a personal choice? Is that something that just had to happen?
It's personal choice. Also a convenience for myself because, you know, I love going to the movies, and that's a shorter drive.
Okay. Fair to say there's no movie theater.
No.
No place to watch movies.
No, not on the reservation. I mean, beside your house, there's no movie theaters or nothing like that.
Okay. For people who live in the tribal areas, how much opportunity is there for them to pursue, I guess, what you would say, traditional occupations and practices?
It really depends, I guess, on the family, because a lot of the traditional stuff, it's up to the family to teach that and provide that. We're actually trying to get more of that type of knowledge in the school. It's a big part of our cultural program, is teaching the kids the language and our traditional ways.
I'm gonna get into traditions and protecting language, but I want to come back again to this idea of, you know, what we understand about, you know, our Miccosukee neighbors and what we don't, because of what we are taught and not taught mm-hmm. in schools. I wanted to know first from you is, you know, the typical education that you got, was it on the tribal lands? Did you go to schools, I guess, you know, in other South Florida districts? For you growing up, what was that like?
Well, actually, I went there for like about Head Start.
Okay.
And then my family, my mother and I, we moved up to Connecticut for about 7 years. You know, she met a man, my stepfather. So I got my primary education up in Connecticut. And then around middle school age, I came back down here. I did a year at a Collier County school. I won't put them out there, but it was not the best experience. And then I spent the rest of my schooling on the school on the reservation.
And not to call out the school, but I'm just curious why it wasn't a good experience for you.
There was a little bit of weird, I don't want to say animosity, but they did let you know that you're a native. And also, I just didn't find the curriculum engaging. Like, when I was in Connecticut, I was great student there, A's and B's and stuff like that. And then when I went to that school, I didn't feel the effort, so I didn't put as much effort in. And I really didn't apply myself until I went back to school on the reservation.
When you were in Connecticut, did you experience that same issue where people had perhaps any kind of prejudice or bias or any issue with the fact that you were a native?
Oddly enough, it was from other, the few experiences I had was from like other minority groups. So that was strange for me.
What is that typically like? I mean, because we hear from, for example, you know, the challenges perhaps, whether it's Latinos or African-Americans may experience, members of the LGBTQ community. What are some of the things that, I guess, Native children deal with?
There's a perception that we're lazy or we're not smart or we don't try. I mean, when I was going to college, I went to college in Full Sail University in Orlando. I would come down here to visit my family. I got pulled over by a state trooper because I was speeding, because that's what young men do, unfortunately. We speed. But, you know, he pulled me out and he's like, oh, what are you? And I was like, oh, I'm Miccosukee. He said to me, oh, I bet you don't do anything with your life.
He said that to you straight to your face?
Yes. So that was a big shock, but I had to keep my composure because, you know, obviously I can't do too much in that situation. But that's the type of stuff we have to deal with, the perception that, you know, we're not educated or we don't care, or we don't apply ourselves.
You're a teacher.
Yeah.
Tell us about the Miccosukee school where you teach. How many students does it have?
Roughly 150 students, I would say. From what I've seen, though, there's been more and more students every year. Our pre-K group is a large group. Our high school class, our graduating class, I know it may not sound like much, but it's roughly around 7 students this year, which is actually a big number for us. Because unfortunately, in the past, we've had like a not so much emphasis on education, which is changing, because it was a big battle between modern and traditional ways, and we're trying to bridge that gap now. But I see more and more kids coming there every year. I see more people taking it serious, so it's been improving.
And is the school that you attended when you were a kid?
Yes.
And so how different is it now compared to when you were a student? And by the way, what grade what age were you when you were there?
That was around 7th grade, I would say. And then I did high school there. A big change, actually, when I was in high school, I remember they had asked us, you know, how many kids are planning to go to college? And it was like me and 3 other kids raised their hands. Last year with our group, we asked them, it was a group of about like 40 or 50 kids, and the majority had raised their hands. For me, that shows like, oh, they feel like they can do more than the previous generation.
What age groups are you teaching?
Primarily, I'm with the 3rd, 4th, and 5th grade, but I do help out with the middle school classes and the high school classes, and I also check up on the primary kids too.
So give us a sense of, you know, what education, the educational system and the curriculum are like for you at your school compared to what you were getting when you were going to, when you were in Connecticut, for example, and you're going to, you know, the local public school?
Well, there's a lot of similar stuff because we're an accredited school, so we have to have the same subjects as a regular school would. But the big difference is our cultural infusion. Like, I'm with the Miccosukee Language Arts Department, which focuses on language, culture, and all that stuff. And for me, that gives, like, a big connection to the past. I feel like when I was in school in Connecticut, even though I loved the school up there, I never got a real sense of history, like, real actual history. Like, up there in New England, it's a big focus on colonialists and the pilgrims and all that stuff. And they downplay the contributions of, you know, the people who helped them. And so for me, when I came to school here, you get more of like, oh, this is the forgotten stuff. Don't forget that we're a part of history, too, and that we're actually still here.
So I always found this fascinating because many years ago I had the opportunity to speak with some folks from the Seminole tribe. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they had this issue about what we're taught in public schools about Native American groups and American history and what's real. And so I'm wondering, like, you know, when you talk about that history, like, are students in schools right now really being taught the truth about the Miccosukee and about any Native group?
Well, did you go to school in South Florida?
In Palm Beach County, yeah.
What history did you get about Native Americans, Miccosukees, and Seminoles?
Very little. It was, you know what? I mean, a lot of the history about Florida was, well, the Spaniards arrived and all this great stuff they did, mm-hmm. and expansion. And then, of course, you know, it wasn't much of a state for many, many years until after the Civil War. And then all of a sudden people started coming down. Very little. Very little.
I mean, that's when I hear expansion, I feel like people are forgetting the other word that begins with E, which is encroachment. I mean, that's what a lot stuff happened like that. Here, even Highway 41, a major road, Native Americans, their tribe, helped the workers. They would sell items to them as they worked on that. They even had Native guides helping them through the swamps, but you don't even get that sense of history, and that's a major part.
And so I'd imagine, see, I'm curious as to the history that you teach in your classes and that what the Miccosukee children are learning is really different, isn't it?
Yeah, actually, right now with my students, we've been going over government, how our government works, but I've also been going through like our own tribal recognition process, how we were recognized by the United States government, and the tactics we had to use to kind of hardball them into working with us.
Again, I'm talking with William Osceola. He teaches at the Miccosukee Indian School, and in talking today about really understanding what our neighbors, our Miccosukee neighbors, you know, how they see the world compared to how the rest of us see the world. And what don't we know about these folks? Hopefully today, maybe we'll get a little bit of insight anyway and learn a little bit more. Tribal history, protecting culture, traditions, and the language, of course. Right now, are Miccosukee members, are they doing enough to protect the traditions and the language, or is it disappearing?
It's I feel like now we're really starting to get it together to really make that push. The younger generation, people my age, you know, we really see the importance of it and kind of what was lacking. Like, we see all the mistakes that, you know, our generation before us made. We don't want to make those same mistakes, and we're trying to figure out, okay, what is the issue here? And part of that, again, is going away from the culture and things like that, because our culture, actually, this is part of our constitution. We have to protect the land. And I emphasize that to our students because I tell them in the United States Constitution, it doesn't say anything about protecting the land, which, you know, maybe that's why they don't really do that much work towards it. More, I mean, here in South Florida, we see all the ramifications of when you just develop and farm and don't really care about what the chemical runoffs and all that stuff is doing. We see it firsthand because that affects, you know, our food supply, our water. That's our backyard. That's our front yard. So that's something that's always been a big deal.
And you talk about the last generation not doing enough. They were losing touch with their history.
Yeah.
Was that on purpose?
No, it's, well, you have to understand, like, we gained federal recognition in 1961. So we've had to do in about 50 years what America had kind of like 2 centuries to figure out. So it's a big rush, that modernization. Like, my grandparents grew up in a camp. They didn't have money. That wasn't the concept that they worked with. So that's something we have had to educate ourselves on, is money, how to handle it, how to manage it, how that system works so it doesn't overtake us, because it really does make you lose focus of what's important when there's a dollar sign in your eyes.
How much of the, to say it's a, the American culture, but I know that, you know, I've also read about that fear that, that American culture, what's on television and our movies and music and our fast food and everything can be very destructive to traditions. I mean, how much of that has played a role?
Well, again, we weren't really introduced to these concepts. It was kind of just thrown at us, so people didn't understand if I drink soda every day, this is going to lead to diabetes, so we have high rate of diabetes and stuff like that. But again, that's I've seen that with the older folks, so we try and educate the younger generation, like, hey, watch out for this because we're dealing with it when we had no idea what was going on.
And by the way, let me correct myself here. I just, because I said American culture, but it's, we're all American culture. It's, but the separation is that, you know, it, I don't know how that is described actually. Is it, there's the native culture and then there's what it's, it, are we the Euro culture or something?
Well, I mean, this may be a little blunt, but I've always heard it turned as like the white man's way.
Okay. No, you know what? I heard that as well. I just didn't know if that was the correct thing.
Oh, I also wanted to say, like, yes, just to clarify, I am an ambassador for the school, but when I state opinions, I'm speaking on behalf of myself because it's a strong cultural belief that we have our own voice and we don't speak for everybody unless, you know, they've been asked to.
So, that it, you know, in having you here on the program, I mean, we didn't have to ask for permission. You could do so if you wanted to.
Well, I did clarify with some elders just some things because, you know, it's that idea of respect, and I don't want to expose things that we feel like we still need to protect. So I did my due diligence.
And did they tell you anything about, you know, what they hope that you would say or not say?
Just to clarify that, you know, these misconceptions people have about us, that's not what we are. You know, get to really understand us, so maybe there's a little bit more value on what we have to say.
Let's talk about those, you know, some of those misconceptions that people have. What's one big one? And I think I know that earlier you were talking about how even when you were approached once by a police officer that they looked at you and said, oh, you're a Native American, so you must be lazy.
Yeah.
But what else?
Well, this is not just limited to our tribe, but, you know, alcoholism, that's a big misconception that all Native Americans are alcoholics. Unfortunately, here, one of the first questions I often get asked by people is, oh, how much money do you get? Which for me is just like, it says a lot about that person asking that question. Like, you have a Native American here, and your first instinct is to ask about money when there's so much more we have to offer. And it's, I don't know, it's something I've always been dealing with. I have different ways to deal with that, but it's never a good feeling.
How much time do you spend, you know, on the Miccosukee lands? And of course, as you said, you don't live there, but how much time do you spend, you know, there? And then of course, you know, in your home area, in your community?
Well, I've been going down there more and more frequently on the weekends. I mean, I'm there every day for work, but on Saturdays or Sundays, like my students, we've been working on a garden project. So I've been going down there on the weekends to help them with that. So it's been more. I'll probably be spending more and more time down there as it gets closer to summertime because we're going to have cultural ceremonies and stuff, so I have to be down there to participate.
Again, having a fascinating conversation with Willie Maciola. He's a teacher at the Miccosukee Indian School, you know, on their tribal lands, and just talking about some of the differences and some of these misconceptions that people may have about our Miccosukee neighbors. So we're going to continue this conversation in a moment here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Again, I'm joined by William Osceola. He is a teacher at the Miccosukee Indian School, and we're talking about, again, you know, our Miccosukee neighbors, but understanding, you know, what were we taught in school? And I was just having this conversation with William. What was I taught in school growing up about any Native group? And you know what? Not a whole lot. Not a whole lot. And so that's why I, William, as I said to you, it's an honor to have you here because I think that, you know, it's an education for us to better understand you and to deal with some of these misconceptions. You know what? I wanted to come to, you know, what you're teaching in school and talk a little bit about tribal history. Let's remind ourselves of how the Miccosukee came to this area of Florida.
Actually, yeah, a few hundred years ago, we were more located in like kind of the Georgia area. I guess people generalize those natives in the area as upper creeks and lower creeks, people who lived in the mountains, people who lived in the valleys. We were part of that group, the lower creeks. And again, I mentioned earlier encroachment. whether it's from tribes and later colonialists or whoever, that kind of pushed us down south. And before we even moved down here, though, we used to have hunting expeditions along the coastline, you know? But again, we had to kind of get away for our own safety, and we just got pushed further and further into the swamplands until we adapted to survive that, and then other people weren't really able to access us.
And then, you know, what is that separation in the history between the Miccosukee and the Seminole?
The Seminoles, we were always kind of working with them because we were very similar backgrounds. But when it comes down to it, the Seminoles kind of have more of a Creek influence, and more of a divide happened during the recognition process when you're really trying to figure out who the two groups of people are. I know in 1954, we had some medicine men and a man named Buffalo Tiger. They went up to Washington, D.C. with a buckskin declaration, they call it. And that buckskin specified on there that, A, we're not Seminoles, we're Miccosukees, we're different people, we're our own people, and B, the best thing anybody could do to help us is leave us alone. So it was kind of during that time where we really started making it known, like, no, we are not them, we're similar, but we have our own ways.
And, you know, there's a difference, too, in how both tribes have dealt with the U.S. government.
Yes, there is. During that process, Seminoles, I guess they had a little bit more help. I don't want to put them out there too much. I'm not bad-mouthing them at all, but the deal they made was kind of more financial. We cared more about the land that we had access to. Because for us, you know, like, oh, this land protected us. It provided for us. You know, it kept us alive. It kept us safe this whole time. We were a part of the Seminoles during the three Seminole Wars that happened, and we survived through those wars. I mean, eventually the United States government just gave up. We are one of the few people that have never been defeated by the government officially.
What is the language?
Our language is called Ilipungi. That's what we speak down on the reservation. It comes from this language, Hichiti, I believe that's what they call it.
And do you speak it?
Yeah, but I actually went, again, I mentioned earlier, I went to Connecticut. When I moved up there for 7 years, it was not integration, it was assimilation, so I lost a lot of the language when I used to be fluent. I've gotten a lot more of it back, like I can understand fairly well, I know a lot of words, but if I'm trying to do a big sentence, it's going to be kind of cut up, like I have to practice, but it's something I've been actively focusing on, and for me, it's actually highlighted the importance of it, because once you lose something, you have to fight for it back, you really see the value of it.
And how many kids, how much time, I should say, is spent, you know, teaching the language and preserving that language in the school?
Well, our classes usually run about 50 minutes, and it's every day. So we hit it every day. We have culture days usually for every grade band at least once a month. And in culture days, it allows us to invite community members in to teach kids, you know, traditional things, whether it's sewing, beading, carving, cooking. And a lot of times they'll talk to the kids in a language. You know, that's how they give them the history and lessons. So we're always trying to give them as much as we can, especially because lately, you know, the modern culture is very alluring, so people kind of drift more towards that and they forget to even just speak daily in the language.
Yeah, do you have any challenges when you're working with kids in that you're trying to teach them this history, teach them the traditions, protect the language, and so forth. And yet, yeah, that allure of the modern world it's there. All of us, we're all susceptible to it.
It's easier, the modern world. That's why it's a big battle, because, you know, a lot of people don't want to work for things. That's not exclusive to any one people. It's just like, oh, why do I just want to sit back and put my legs up, you know? But it's a fight to preserve what we have, and it's a fight worth doing. It's work, but work is good for people. It gives you character, responsibility, and stuff like that. So it's an ongoing battle, but I feel good about the direction we're heading in.
I have always, for me, I love the colors, you know, that I've always seen any Native group in their clothes and some of their costumes. I'm sorry, I don't mean to say if that's their costumes, but, you know, the outfits that I've seen them wear. You're sitting in here with me now and you're wearing this vest. It's beautiful colors. I mean, colors and patterns are so important in the story of each tribe. But, I mean, tell me how and how, again, you continue to preserve that tradition.
Well, for us, I always tell the kids, this is art right here. It's tradition, but it's also art. It's something you could take pride in, and it's a means of expression. I can't speak specifically to the patterns here, but we do have specific patchwork that represent different things, like whether it's like a tree or lightning bolts or a man on a horse or something like that, you know? to me, it's just, it feels connected in a way almost like when you see cave paintings. It's just like people yearning to express themselves however they can. So they even do it in the fabric.
And foods. What about foods? You still have the traditional foods, traditional recipes?
Yeah, we do that. We have a drink. I guess the English way to say it would be sofki. It's an acquired taste because, you know, it's more about the texture of it. It's very filling. It could be made from like cornmeal or roasted corn or stuff like that, oatmeal. The most traditional one I know of really is made from guava, but I'm not a big fan of that one.
Wait, the first one is like, it's just, I'm thinking the texture, because you said oatmeal, it's that thick?
Well, it's watered down some, so you can drink it, but okay. It's basically, if you're drinking sofki, you probably shouldn't have breakfast because it's going to fill you up.
And as you said, it's an acquired taste. That's good.
I've heard some people just like, oh, no, I can't. This is just like, ugh, it's sludge or something, but I don't know.
You know what? Earlier you said that one of the things that you felt was a positive is that when you ask kids at the school how many of them want to go to college, so many more say now that they do. How is that a good thing? And, you know, is there any fear that, again, they can lose that connection?
There is that fear, but I feel like the work we're doing and what the community is starting to do now is really emphasize, you know, like, it's all right to learn about the modern ways and get as much of that information as you can, but be sure to come back with it so we can improve things here. I always tell my students, you know, you have to understand as much about the modern world as you can so we can protect our traditional ways, or else it's just going to overcome it. You know, you always have to learn as much as you can. I mean, I was thinking about this, and it's like, unless your name is Oedipus, ignorance is not bliss.
Yeah, good point. That's a good point. How do you and, you know, your students view history? Do you see, because you kept saying encroachment, so I wonder, do you see, you know, the Europeans who came here, you know, all of the different groups of people who came to this country and just started to take chunks of land and, you know, create cities and push everything out of the way as the enemy?
That happened so long ago that to me, I just see it as like, okay, that was a continuation of civilization. They're evolving through their feelings, how they deal with things. And like so much of American institutions have kind of started off from not the best intentions, but they've shifted over the centuries into kind of trying to help more and more people. So I always look at it that way, like, okay, it may not have started off for the best reasons, but you can shape it to better serve the people, and we're part of the people. So how do we make sure we have our voice in that? So like students, when they read like things like the Declaration of Independence, it says in there part of the reason they want their independence is so they can fight back against the savages who are trying to destroy them, referring to the Native Americans. I've known students, they read that, it's a shock because it's like, this is the country and this is how they view us. But I always tell them, like, okay, it makes you angry, that's valid, but what are you going to do with that anger? And for me, it's a message of take that anger and try and fix whatever's making you angry. Because that's a problem. You don't want to just stew in your anger because that's just going to turn you into a resentful person who's just bitter and not really trying to improve things around them.
And, you know, do you still deal with, you know, some of these, the prejudices that you run into? I mean, I don't know when this issue came up of, you know, when you had the interaction with a police officer. Is that...
That was about 8 years ago.
Okay. Does that still happen? Do you know people like some of your students or other people, you know, in the tribe that...
Yeah, some of my students have dealt with things like that, with just perceptions that even amongst their own community members, like the school has been built up so much over the years. We've improved it so much, even from when I was there. And the community members who went there, you know, they may not have applied themselves that much. So that's kind of what they feel like the next generation is doing, what they did. And it's all around, like, we're doing great stuff there. But we need people to realize that, or else it's just going to be this idea that we're not applying ourselves. And to me, that's a big discredit to our students and our teachers there, because they're doing great stuff. Like, the way kids think about things, our community members, the children, it's very perceptive, and it's kind of like, well, you're approaching this like an adult would, but maybe even more mature than I've heard some adults talk about these subjects when it comes to things like alcohol abuse or, you know, money problems, things like that.
You know what? I wanted to know about, you know, coming back to the school just a little bit, because I know that there are some of the standards, you know, that the state has You do have to meet those standards, but obviously, you know, and this goes back to the Obama administration, there's obviously also just the opportunity for Native tribes to be able to protect that culture. And so they, you don't have to meet all the same student standards, right?
Well, we're an advanced ed accredited school, so we have to meet those standards. Yeah, because we want to make sure our kids, their degree is valid, their diploma is valid, that they can get to any school they need to based off the education we provide. We're a full service school. We want to set the kids up for the best possible future they could have.
So that if they left and went to a public school, say in Collier County or Broward County, it's they could just jump right in.
Oftentimes, the issue we have is a kid will leave our school, they'll go to a school out wherever in this area, and then when they come back, their paperwork is a complete mess. Things aren't filed right, and we have to kind of pick up the pieces. For me, this is a larger issue that affects the country, the lack of investment in public education. I've always felt like if they're not trying to invest in your education, they don't want you to learn what's really going on. If you don't really know what's going on, people are able to have more power over you. They feed you information they want, and you can't think critically for yourself.
Let me finish with this. I remember when I was living out west and I speaking to different tribal members out west in places like Colorado and Nevada. And, you know, one of the fears is that as time passes, it's not just that you lose culture and you lose language and you lose some of these things, but it's also the fact that tribes can also just continue to shrink.
Yes.
Is that happening?
We've kind of kept steady population rates. I think it's around hovering around 600, but it increases. Like I said, we've had more and more students at the school, so it's expanding. The population is.
The students, what are they working on today?
Well, I'm imagining right now majority of them are going to be working on their STEAM projects. We have our STEAM fair coming up. It's like science, engineering, and all that stuff. Actually, I believe we had invited one of your coworkers here. If you would like to come, it's also an invitation to you.
I definitely will accept that invitation. Thank you so much. William Osceola, again, he teaches at the Miccosukee Indian School. William, it's been a pleasure and an honor. I really appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, and you know what? Invitation for you to come in anytime. And please bring your students. We'd love to have them.
Thank you. We'd appreciate that very much.
All right. All right. Coming up next on Sundial, the Marlins don't even look like the team we remember. And yesterday they fired their mascot. I'll explain that in a minute. Here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. All right, well, the Miami Marlins just continue to get rid of people, and they're making a bunch of changes, and sometimes it just doesn't make any sense. But you know what? It started with Giancarlo Stanton. You know, he was sent away. Let's see, Marcell Ozuna, gone. Christian Yelich, gone. Now, John DeChicco. Who is this guy? Well, he played Billy the Marlin, the team's mascot. Now, the mascot's going to be back next year, so as far as we know, I mean, you know, he's not fired, but the guy who played the mascot is gone. What happened? What's going on with the Marlins? You know what? We're joined now by Tim Healy. He's a sports reporter with the South Florida Sun Sentinel, and we're going to try to figure this out. Tim, welcome back.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing great. All right, so you know what? Who is this guy who played the mascot, and why did he lose his job?
Who he was, you know, he's just a local guy, a longtime team employee whose job for the past almost decade and a half was being the primary person inside the Billy the Marlin outfit. So he's not by any means, you know, a public-facing employee or anything. But and yet everybody sees him. He's always on TV, always around the ballpark and at various community events. And as for why he lost his job, that's not clear. The Marlins didn't comment. I reached out to John himself and haven't gotten a response. So the why question is not clear. There is a little bit of precedent in terms of mascot change in Marlins history. They made a change that put John in this job in around 03, and I believe at the time the bosses were not exactly enthused about paying the previous mascot guy as much as he was making. So, you know, who knows what the case here was, but nobody's really saying.
All right, so there is somebody who's going to be pushed up, I guess, get promoted to become the new mascot.
Yes, Billy the Marlin as a character, as team mascot, isn't going anywhere. Actually, he'll be around Fan Fest Saturday at Marlins Park. And, you know, with, you know, normal mascot situations, there's always a backup. You know, in case, the guy at the top of the depth chart was sick or couldn't make it or whatever, you know, there's always somebody else who can hop in the costume and goof around with the fans. So rest assured, Billy the Marlin will continue to be a presence around the team.
All right, so now, look, I've over the years, you know, when I was in, back in the day when I was a sports reporter, I got to meet some of these mascots, and I heard some of those guys, they could make some pretty good money. How much is a guy like, well, the guy who plays Billy the Marlin, kind of making a year?
You know, I couldn't tell you. I have no idea about how much mascots make, but in the grand scheme of running a baseball team, it's not a lot. Obviously, the biggest expense for any baseball team is the major league roster, and any really front office employees, business side employees, it's pennies comparatively. So if this was a money-saving move, and I'm not sure that it is, it's an interesting spot to save money, let's say.
And what I had learned is what a lot of money that these guys make isn't being the mascot of the team, but it's a lot of the appearances they will make throughout the year, because they're going to be at all kinds of parties and events. You know what? This team just doesn't seem recognizable. I mean, so many stars gone. And yet the owner, one of the owners, I should say, Derek Jeter, says that the team's going to make money next year. How does he figure that?
Well, the way it works with the finances, the books, the ledger this year is every major league team is going to receive in the coming month, a one-time payment of $50 million as a result of Major League Baseball selling a big piece of its technology arm, BAM, Major League or MLB Advanced Media, to Disney. So that was a huge deal that happened last year, and each individual major league club ownership is receiving their $50 million payment from that. I think it's coming in March. So that $50 million is a huge difference maker in terms of whether the Marlins in 2018 will be profitable or not. Because when you think about it, $50 million plus $20 million for their TV deal, that's $70 right there. That covers almost all of the major league payroll. So as far as other income, you know, tickets, concessions, things like that, that'll be, you know, definitely lesser amount. But that's kind of how they're swinging it this year in terms of making a profit. And cutting the major league payroll from $115 million to less than $90 million, that helps too.
Yeah, I don't know what he expects he's going to make in ticket sales and concessions. This team doesn't...
Yeah, not very much.
Yeah, it's not going to win much, and they are already having attendance issues. Let me finish up real quickly with this. There were some complaints by the Players Union to the league that, you know, what the Marlins are doing is just... it's really bad, and that the league should step in. But, I mean, are they going to, and what would they do?
There's... As far as I can tell right now, going to be any stepping in. There's a difference between the union kind of putting up a stink, complaining about the Marlins offseason and the Pirates offseason, for that matter. That's a long way away from actually formally filing a grievance, which has happened in the past with the Marlins and the union. So there's some history there. But what's interesting about this is the league has no problem, at least publicly, with what the Marlins are doing. Commissioner Rob Manfred went on the record as early as November and has reiterated the sentiment since then that, you know, it's a new ownership group. They should get a shot to essentially do as they see fit in terms of trying to turn the organization around. So there's definitely a grace period from Major League Baseball, even if the union isn't happy about it.
We'll see what happens. All right. You know what? I mean, it's like a new owner of a house. You want to make it your house, you might have to tear it down first. Tim Healy, again,
exactly.
Sports reporter with the South Florida Sun Sentinel, man. Thanks so much.
Excellent. Thank you.
And, you know, also just to mention, too, is that yesterday the Marlins showed off their new logo as for their 25th anniversary. And it's really the old logo from way back. So maybe they're hoping we can go back in time to when we were a good team. We'll see. Well, that's the program for today. Thank you so much for listening. Again, you can always find us online, WLRN.org, or find us on iTunes. Just look up WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. That's the program. We'll talk to you tomorrow.